Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco, continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, the postmodern family.
The postmodern family? The postmodern family, John. Well, what do you mean by the postmodern family?
Well, I suppose postmodern is just a way of saying not your traditional family. It's the Pomo fam versus the Trad fam, Ken. Ozzie and Harriet versus who? The Gilmore Girls? Ugly Betty? Ellen and Lori? Where do you put the Osbournes? Pomo fam, Trad fam, or just weird fam?
You know, you don't have to draw your examples from television, John. We live in California. Right in your own neighborhood, there are countless gay couples and their children, single mother families, single father families, communes of superannuated hippies, families with working mothers and stay-at-home fathers, interracial families, interethnic families, old guys with trophy wives, cougars with young husbands, and all sorts of other non-Aussie-type families, not traditional like Ozzie and Harriet, nor even like Ozzy Osbourne.
Three cheers for California, Ken, but big deal. What's philosophical about all that? Families, like everything else, change. So what?
Well, you have a point in a way. Philosophical education often addresses questions of the individual and the state, but seldom do we read at all about the individual and the family.
Yeah, I do have a point. The individual in the state's a tried and true staple of philosophy, a part of every graduate and undergraduate curriculum, an object of inquiry of the greats from Plato to Hume to Rawls.
But look, John, all the same sorts of questions come up. We think parents have authority over their children. Why? And what are parents, anyway? Are their rights symmetrical with respect to their children? Do mothers and fathers have the same rights? And what is the best sort of family? What is a just organization of responsibilities and rights within the family? Just like these questions come up with the state, they come up with the family.
I suppose while I've been diverted with other things, feminists have developed all sorts of ideas about this.
Well, not just feminists, but lots of people. You're exactly right. Over the past 40 years, while you've been obsessed with proper names, the identity sign, and other esoterica, feminists and others have asked basic questions about the family.
Well, so what are the basic ideas they've come up with?
Well, there are lots of them, but on the conservative side, there's a Hegelian kind of position. Traditional marriage is rooted in the logic of marriage, with the traditional gender roles of male and female complementing one another and completing one another, a sort of Hegelian synthesis. Then there's a sort of liberal position, a traditional family, but loosen up the gender roles. There's also a kind of John Stuart Mill-like position. Let people, individuals, experiment with different ways of living together. It's their right. I kind of like that kind of position.
Yeah, well, I'm all for right. It's their right. But what they do affects others, particularly their children. Isn't the Ozzie and Harriet model clearly the right one? I mean, if it was good enough for Ozzie and Harriet and Ricky and Lucy and the Huxtables and my parents and the Osbournes, for that matter, not to mention Mary and Joseph, isn't it good enough for everyone?
Mary and Joseph, that's surrogate parents.
Oh, yeah.
You heard right there, John. Your view is not very philosophical, and it doesn't sound like you philosophically. I mean, is there some a priori guarantee that a permanent relationship between a heterosexual couple is the best way, say, to raise children?
Well, you got me there, Ken. I'm divided between my own experience, which is all Ozzie and Harriet, and my philosophical sympathies, which are all John Stuart Mill. Gay marriage, polygamy, single mothers, single fathers, kibbutzes, who knows what's best, or if there is any best. Let them all thrive. But me, I've been in a traditional marriage for 46 years, so I doubt if I'll be the one doing the experimenting. Does anyone really know anything about what works and doesn't?
Well, we have somebody who knows something about what works and doesn't. It's our guest from Stanford, Michael Rosenfeld, author of The Age of Independence, Interracial Unions, Same-Sex Unions, and the Changing American Family.
Michael's going to join us in a few minutes, but first our roving philosophical reporter, Rena Palta, talked to someone on the front lines of the modern family. She wanted to find out how true to life our Ozzie and Harriet model really is. She files this report.
The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet starred the real-life Nelson family.
Here is Ozzie, who plays the part of Ozzie Nelson. And, of course, his lovely wife, Harriet, as Harriet Nelson.
Episodes revolved around such conflicts as what to write in a thank you note.
I think, Rick, you just ought to write a real nice letter to Iggy and tell him you enjoyed reading the book and you appreciate his thoughtfulness.
Okay, Pop, if you say so.
I think that's best, too, dear.
Okay, Ma, if you say so.
I agree with Mom and Pop.
Okay, David, if you say so.
Some people still look back on this era as a golden age of healthy family life. Others see it as
the way we never were, which is the idea that the mythical Hozzie and Harriet family is the norm, and in fact, that's not true.
M. Sue Talia is a private family court judge based in Walnut Creek, California.
I see all kinds of families, from same-sex parents, two mothers, two fathers. I see step-parents, extended families. Parents may have children from two or more prior relationships. All of these are family relationships. So it is very limiting and frankly quite naive to think of family as simply a husband, wife, and two children.
There are lots of things that can trigger the creation of a family. Having children, getting married, entering into a domestic partnership. Talia and other family court judges deal with what's commonly thought of as the end or dissolution of a family, divorce. But Talia says it's not that simple.
You cannot unring the bell. You've created legal relationships, you've created property rights, you've created support rights, and when somebody comes in and says, oops, I made a mistake, let's just erase it. Those ripples are out there and they've been set in motion, and I can't fix that. I cannot pretend that it didn't happen, because it does create legal relationships and it does create rights and responsibilities.
After a divorce, there's the division of financial assets, custody rights, which school children should attend, and even fights over which grandparents should have time with the kids. It's Talia's job to sort out and assign these rights and responsibilities, essentially defining what this new version of a family will be. She says she carries around a model of an ideal family in her head, and it's nothing like Hozzie and Harriet.
I still remember a case years ago where the parties got divorced, they had a single child, and they actually bought property next door to each other. There was a little creek that divided the properties and a little footbridge. And so the five-year-old could go back and forth between mom's house and dad's house, and that was very unusual. And it was because the parents, there was no societal norm for that. They were just smart enough and they cared enough about their child that they said, we're going to do this in a way that works for him. And if that means I have to live next door to you and I have to see your girlfriend coming and going, that's the way it's going to be, because this is what's good for our son.
Over her 3 decades working in family law, Judge Talia says she's seen more and more of a move towards taking personal responsibility.
I think they're getting better. I've been doing this work since 1977. And what I have seen is an evolution of what I think is increasing responsibility in terms of people's relationships with one another. I'm an optimist. I think we are evolving as a society, and I think we are better than we were 10 years ago, and I think we'll be better 25 years from now.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Rena Palta.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're joined by Michael Rosenfeld. He's a professor of sociology at Stanford University. He's author of The Age of Independence, Interracial Unions, Same-Sex Unions, and the Changing American Family. Michael, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Glad to be here.
Well, Michael, how'd you get interested in the changing family?
I started out, I think, the way a lot of people start out, which is I had this perception that the world was changing around me. And then I wanted to know, has the world always been changing? Are my perceptions right? Is there any way to figure out if we're really living in an age of change, or whether it's just how people perceive the world?
So we've heard from Rena Palta's roving philosophical reporter that families don't really fit the Hozzie and Harriet model. Why did we move away from the Hozzie and Harriet model? Is it all just a cultural reaction to Ricky Nelson's premature death, or?
Part of the reason we had always one kind of family in the past was that there were a lot of constraints on what you could do. And one of those constraints was people used to marry young. We now live in an age where we're marrying later. We're forming our own families later in life. If you think about the kind of family you can form when you're 20 years old, it's really only the kind of family that's immediately available, where the model is around you. You're only exposed to people who are like you, for instance, in the neighborhood you grow up with your parents. Same race people, same religion people, usually the same social class. And so there's only one model available to you. Now we live in an age where people marry later. Why? Well, we send our children to college. They have the skills to work for someone other than their dad. They make their own way in the world. They meet people who aren't exactly mom and dad's mold of what they're supposed to meet.
Yeah, I know this firsthand. My wife is from Hawaii. We met in graduate school in Chicago, where neither of us grew up, miles and miles away from our parents. My wife is Japanese American, and her parents were like shocked at the idea, and she could not have met me in her neighborhood, in her circle of friends and family. So I resonate to what you're saying.
Yeah. So how did you, I mean, why did you wait till you were so old to get married? I got married at 19. I mean, why not? It's a lot of fun.
Well, it was a lot of fun between 19 and 27 when I got married too. But let me ask you about this. So look, you have this notion called the age of independence, right? You think of that as a new life stage?
Yeah. It used to be when people were single in their 20s, they lived with their parents. And one of the reasons people wanted to get married early was they didn't want to live with their parents anymore. But they couldn't support themselves. So what's changed really in the post-1960 American world is our young adults have the kind of education that allows them to find a job outside of the family. And women also have access to the labor market. And then they don't have to get married right away. They can wait. And if you don't have to get married right away, sometimes you want to wait for something better to come along.
Now, it's what you're describing, a sort of upper income phenomenon. I mean, isn't young marriage, or at least young relationships that the children come from, still pretty common among the less financially well off?
People with only high school educations tend to marry earlier. That's true. But what's happened in the past 50 years is that, you know, the middle class of the United States has risen to level of economic standing that only rich people had 50 years ago. So there's a whole new class of people who, for instance, consider sending their children to college. 60% of Americans have some college who are old enough to have gone through it.
Yeah, and in the old days, that percentage was a lot lower, right?
Well, right. In 1940, it was about 12%.
Right, so we've gone from 12% to college to 60%.
Right.
But I wanted to ask you about this, because in reading your book, I had this thought. Well, people go to all kinds of colleges, community colleges, all that. I mean, and when you say have some college, it's not like everybody goes off from the West Coast to the East Coast. So a lot of it, I mean, how much of this independence that you talk about, I mean, how big of a deal is it really? Because if you're going to junior college near home, I mean, isn't it the same?
Even if you go to junior college near home, you're probably meeting people who are different from the people you went to high school with. So that's number one. Number two is the education you can get at the junior college, even if, let's say, you're going to join the Army or something, brings you to other places. There's a lot more travel than there ever used to be, and that has to do with technology. And there's also the internet. The internet gives people access to potential partners who are far away. You don't have to meet them at the local park.
Okay. So the phenomenon that drives family change, in your view, is basically, let's see if I got this right. I'm going to put this crudely, a change in the meat market. That is to say, the market of available mates has radically changed.
Absolutely. We're no longer constrained by the neighborhood our parents choose for us.
Right. So during this age of independence, which is, I guess, between 18 and 28, roughly, so people discover possible spouses from much different ethnic backgrounds, racial backgrounds. Maybe they discover that they're gay. Maybe they discover that they want to, live in a... I mean, are marriages, or at least family groups of adults that are not one-on-one, polygamous, or what's the opposite of polygamous?
Monogamous.
Yeah, that one too. are they really making a comeback? Or
we don't really have any data on polygamy, so I can't answer that question. Kind of a data guy.
You're kind of a data guy. I'm going to ask you a theory question.
Yeah, what's data?
I'm going to ask you a philosopher's question. So one of the things is that this meat market changes. But the people are still formed in families, and you would think their values are still formed in their families. So why does it matter so much that the meat market changes? So if people have racial antipathy, if they grow up with racial antipathy or homophobia or whatever, I mean, why would the mere change in the meat market drive family change?
One of the things we know about how attitudes are formed is that young adulthood is a time when attitudes are really plastic. People really change their worldview a lot during the time that, you know, the late teens and the 20s, when they're traveling for the first time, when they move away from home, when they meet people for the first time. And it's possible, even if you come from a family that, for instance, has racial antipathy in its background, to discover different. And it's fairly common in American families for people who have a different race partner to say that, you know, I have a grandma who doesn't agree with this.
Yeah. So in our next segment, I want to ask you about, see, it sounds to me like this is opening up a possible generation gap. That mm-hmm. one of the things you thought family used to be for is transmitting values from generation to generation. But it sounds like this can't happen in the same way, on your view. Briefly, is that right or wrong?
That's right. The modern world has sort of undermined the transmission of values between generations, and that happens in lots of ways. Part of it goes back to the Industrial Revolution when the state took over schooling from families.
Well, we're going to have to dig into that some more. This is a big and important question and probably causes conservatives conniptions. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is the postmodern family. Our guest is Michael Rosenfeld, author of The Age of Independence, Interracial Unions, Same-Sex Unions, and the Changing American Family.
Coming up, what do we know about the strengths and weaknesses of various ways of organizing a family?
When Philosophy Talk continues.
Winding up as your own grandfather. Now that's a postmodern family. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, and we're talking about the postmodern family with our guest Michael Rosenfeld, author of The Age of Independence, Interracial Unions, Same-Sex Unions, and the Changing American Family. Michael, there are certainly are lots of opinions, lots of them, among philosophers, politicians, religious folks, and others about what families ought to be like. I mean, Hegel thinks heterosexual union between a man and a woman in marriage is a duty. But you're a data-driven guy. Mm-hmm. What is known about the real strengths and weaknesses of various ways of organizing families?
The one thing we know most strongly is that all families do radically better than the other option. The other option is children being raised by the state. Mm-hmm. So there are some subtle differences between family types in outcomes, and we're not always sure whether that's because the heterosexual married couples have more money. There's two adults instead of one. That makes a big difference in terms of supervision of the kids. It used to be assumed that we didn't know anything about outcomes for children raised by same-sex couples, for instance. And this was used very often to say, well, if we don't know, how can we let them raise kids? But the truth is, we do know. The census has quite a lot of children being raised by same-sex couples, and they actually do just fine. They don't have any negative outcomes.
They do just fine along, I mean, what measures of
well? The only measure we have in the census is how well they make progress through school, which is an important one because kids who don't make good progress through school, who get left back, they end up not graduating high school, and all sorts of bad things follow from that. So to the extent that we can say, it seems pretty clear from the data, you know, more data would be better, but we have pretty good data that shows that same-sex couples do just as good a job raising children as heterosexual couples do.
This is Philosophy Talk. Our guest is Stanford sociologist Michael Rosenfeld. Are you part of a traditional family? A non-traditional family? How has your family experience shaped your life? Share your experiences and your opinions.
Join the conversation. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And there's also a live blog going on that you can get at through that address, too.
Yeah. So, look, Michael, I was reading this article in preparation for the show about Scandinavia, mm-hmm. and where marriage is disappearing. And the guy who wrote it, I can't remember his name right now, argued that one of the reasons that marriage is disappearing in Scandinavia is because of gay marriage. Gay marriage, he says, is both a cause of the disappearance of marriage and an effect of the disappearance of marriage. What's going on in Scandinavia?
You can't blame the gays, Ken. Come on.
Well, that wasn't my argument.
Here's the thing. Only 1% or 2% of all the couples are same-sex couples.
In Scandinavia?
Everywhere. So whatever is going on in the heterosexual world, it's not the fault of the same-sex couples. What they have in Scandinavia is simply a system of what we used to call common law marriage, which is people make a commitment to each other, but they don't need the license. And that's how it used to be in the United States in the early 19th century. It was enough to say, you and I are together, this is our family, we have a commitment between ourselves. In the United States, it was the law that in the 19th century made people go down to the county courthouse and formalize the union. So I don't think the Scandinavian family is actually as different from ours as we sometimes to believe.
So, okay, so I'm new to this literature. So it's not true that Scandinavian marriage rates are way, way down?
Yeah,
from...
they have low marriage rates, but they have couple rates.
Yeah, high cohabitation rates, but low marriage rates.
For them, a lot of the cohabiting couples are like our married couples. They just haven't, they just don't have the license because they don't need the license.
I mean, I can only offer anecdotal evidence, but I spent a fair amount of time in the Basque Country, they raise their eyebrows when you indicate that you're, you know, here's a couple with a couple of children, and you're surprised they're not married, and they look at you like, well, where have you been, buddy? And I've never heard any of them mention that anything to do with marriage.
Right.
Of course, they don't read the whatever it is,
the weekly standard.
So
the number, we'd love to have you join this conversation. We'd love to. Are you part of a traditional family, a non-traditional family? What are your experiences like? What are your opinions? The number to call is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And if you'd like to share your comment with the world, you can leave a comment on our live blog entry, which we're monitoring. And we've got a caller in the line now, Marcia in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Marcia.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay, what's your comment or question?
I just have a comment to make. I was raised by in a large family in Canada, traditional farming community, six kids, two parents, and now I'm in San Francisco, a single mom raising a mixed race child, and I find that he doesn't necessarily feel out of place because in San Francisco there's so many alternative families. I wouldn't have wanted to raise him back in the community I grew up in. When we go back there, we do stand out. I think a lot of it depends on the community where you raise your children, what the norm is there. I think kids want to feel something similar to everybody else, where if their similarity is that they're different, do you know what I mean? Then that's still comforting to them.
Yeah, thanks for the comment, Marcia. Michael, you got any response to that?
Cities like San Francisco have always been the kind of places that people come to because the rules are more open. And you get more diversity here. There's a higher concentration of same-sex unions in the cities and interracial unions and extramarital cohabitation. And partly... in the modern world, it's easier to move to the city than it used to be when you had to ride your horse there in the old days. So that means it's easier for people to get to a place where they know they're more likely to be accepted, and that's important.
Yeah, in the suburbs, it's a little different, right? I mean, is there a big distinction between the suburban configuration of family and the urban configuration of family?
There is.
And even, say, the rural configuration of family?
There certainly is. I mean, everything about American social and political life falls onto an urban-rural suburban axis. I mean, the red state, blue state division is really an urban versus everybody else division. Suburban families are more likely to have kids. Urban couples are likely to be younger. So there's all sorts of differences.
Right. But, okay, so look, I still want to go back to the kind of what families are for. You kind of shrugged your shoulders at the fact that Scandinavia has low rates of marriage and high rates of cohabitation, adult cohabitation, as if it made no difference to anything. But some people might think, well, cohabitation isn't the same kind of commitment. One of the things Hegel talked about is that the couples in a marriage have to will the marriage, that is, will their union. And that's different from being, and he called that love, and he called that ethical life, but that's different from just being inclined for as long as you feel like being inclined. It's a commitment to an ongoing thing that civil society recognizes and institutionalizes and therefore gives it a kind, makes it a distinctive moral sphere. Is it really just the cohabitation between adults and marriage are just kind of different ways?
I agree with you in this sense. I think the government needs to make it easier for people to stay in a long-term commitment. And one of the things that's nice about the marriage law in the United States is that there's all sorts of rights and benefits to marriage that makes it a little harder for people to decide they want to break up and move apart. And that's part of the reason why I think it's important for those rights to be extended to committed couples, regardless of gender, who want to be together, because couplehood is important. It's important, you know, those two people can take better care of each other than anyone else can take of either of them. And it's the most efficient way for us to care for ourselves.
Right.
Well, I mean, we ought to separate three things here, I guess. One is just the fact of a union, which may, for some couples, be as strong a commitment as is possible. And then there's the civil recognition by the state, and then there's a religious recognition, which is historically, I suppose, goes back further, but at least in modern Europe, maybe in modern America, isn't so important to people. If the religious dimension of marriage just kind of recedes into the background, do you think it'll make much difference?
You know, you don't want to assume. There's a lot of religious diversity in the United States, and there's plenty of churches and synagogues. I don't know about the mosques, but there probably are those too, that are happy to marry same-sex couples. So it's not, you know, the big religious institutions may have a sort of publicly known position on this, but there's actually a tremendous amount of religious diversity. You can find a church or synagogue or house of worship that's consistent with you in the big cities in the United States.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the changing nature of the American family with Michael Rosenfeld, author of The Age of Independence, Interracial Unions, Same-Sex Unions, and the Changing American Family. We'd love to know what you think about this topic. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Or finally, leave a comment for the world to see on our live blog at theblog.philosophytalk.org. And we've got a caller on the line now, Bob in Sonoma. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Bob.
Rob.
Oh, Rob. Sorry. Sorry, Rob.
I've just got this Age of Independence sounds great, but early on, there's got to be a value in a child having a role model from each gender, male and female, just some inherent value to that that might be lost in all these non-traditional marriages, however traditional that was or wasn't in the first place. But there's got to be some value in the two gender role models.
What do you think, Michael? Thanks for the call, Rob.
That's a great question. I think scholars used to always assume that was the case, that children learned gender from their parents. And they certainly do in part. But it also turns out that children learn a lot about gender from their peers. It's the peer group that actually teaches them a lot about gender. And of course, children raised by same-sex couples have access to pretty much the same peer group as everybody else.
Right. There's a slogan that some developmental psychologists use these days. Parents don't socialize children. Children socialize children.
Right.
And you look in the playground, like this, people think gender roles are culturally variable and we can enforce them, we the adults. But you look at children in the playground and they are the ones who enforce various gender segregations and stuff like that. It's actually fascinating literature.
It is.
So there's gender roles and sex roles. Can a gay couple provide role models for both genders without too much difficulty?
Yeah, I think the point is that children find those gender role examples in their peer group, and they learn gender. Children are socialized to gender by their peers mostly, and a lot of things that children go on to do, because we live in a world where all that education comes from outside of the family, they learn it from outside the family.
So there's a movement that's connected with religious conservatism, but not just that, for homeschooling and really keeping the child to a peer group that's more under the parents' control. Do you have much data on how those families do compared to other families?
I don't have any data on that. That's a really interesting question. But even the homeschooled kids, they're eventually going to leave home. And one of the things we do know about how parents raise children in general is that they raise them with a lot more tolerance. They raise them to think for themselves because they're expecting them to go out on their own. And that's true for all kinds of families. And that means that the children have to figure this stuff out for themselves.
Yeah. We've got a caller in line, Ying in San Jose. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ying.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. What's your comment or question?
This is a really great program, and I was really intrigued by your discussion about civil reunion and marriage. Actually, I was pro-traditional marriage because I was from China, a very traditional family. My boyfriend is from France, so civil reunion is very common in his country. We had extensive talk for the last 4 years we were together. And eventually, I feel I was convinced, because if people decided to stay in civil reunion and committed to each other, they shouldn't be lured or forced into traditional marriage by using state benefits. Instead, I think the state should extend benefits to committed civil reunion couples. Because if two people are not really committed to each other, then just by giving them tax breaks or maybe a little bit like hospital visitation rights, they're going to stay together, but doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be committed together in difficulties. And it doesn't contribute to how much they're going to take care of each other. So that shouldn't be a definition. This is what I don't agree with your comment.
Okay, thank you, Inge. What's your...
Yeah, I think, well, in the United States, couples who are cohabiting but not married, they tend to break up fairly quickly. People go through partners fairly quickly. But part of that is because you marry the person you really plan to settle down with, and cohabitation is less of a commitment. We could certainly change the rules and make cohabitation have all the legal benefits of marriage. Domestic partnerships, for instance, is sort of like that. I wouldn't be against it. I think the state needs to do whatever it can to help families in all their variety succeed.
But, you know, I mean, there's a deep question. You said people who are cohabiting but not married tend to break up quickly.
Yes.
I mean, that goes back to this Hegelian thing. Marriage is a distinctive thing where people will the union. They don't, and they're not just inclined to one another. They will the union, and that union takes on a moral significance through that willing. I mean, isn't there something to that idea? I mean, and that's, I know that's a conservative thought of, in a way, about the sanctity of marriage, rather than just these other things. I mean, what do you think about that?
I think there is value to that. I think you know, the ancient traditions bring extra weight and seriousness to unions, and that extra weight and seriousness does help people stay together. I think you know, history works in a funny way. I mean, one of the things that happens when you go to a wedding ceremony is they invoke all that history, and it somehow empowers people.
Right. Right. I think that's very important. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the postmodern family with Michael Rosenfeld, author of The Age of Independence, Interracial Unions, Same-Sex Unions, and the Changing American Family.
Gays want to get married. Increasingly, heterosexual couples don't bother to get married, even when they have children. What's your experience? Is marriage worth fighting about? Is marriage worth fighting for? Or is marriage like the polo club, just a relic of the past, best forgotten? Share your opinion.
We'll get to more calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Sisters are clearly part of the family, but who else will get to count as family in the future? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, radio that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the postmodern family with Michael Rosenfeld, author of The Age of Independence, Interracial Unions, Same-Sex Unions, and the Changing American Family. Look, Michael, I'm not a very conservative guy. I'm pretty progressive. But something you said and something we've been talking about, I think there's a conservative case to be made here. And I just want to look, one of the things that families are for is transmitting values from generation to generation. It's also for caring for the daily physical and emotional needs of its members, right? And it's also this kind of social... It's also for narrating your life. It gives you the first terms in which you're going to narrate your continuing life. Now, one of the things in your book, I think you document, that these generational bonds are being broken. Now, if those generational bonds are being broken, and each generation is sort of starts anew, well, all that goes with these generational bonds go. I mean, the transmitting of narrative, the transmitting of value, and, you know, the old care for the young in their age of dependency. The young move away. Who's going to care for the old in their later stage of dependency if we let family just... I mean, this traditional family did something, and how do we just do without it?
Well, we're not doing without it. We have still lots of traditional families, and we have lots of other families that work the way traditional families always did. But I think it is true that we live in an era of uncertainty. This is something about the postmodern family, which is the rules are a little bit up for grabs. And if you aren't absolutely sure what the rules are, it can be a pretty confusing world.
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the postmodern family. We'd love to have you join this conversation. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And we've got Magdalena in San Francisco's on the line. You've got a good story for us, don't you, Magdalena? Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Well, thanks for having me. Thank you so much for talking about this. I think it's absolutely essential that we just keep talking about it. And I appreciate so much what you were saying about how kids, I love that, that kids socialize each other. It's not parents socializing kids, it's kids socializing kids. And I was raised by lesbians from 8 months on before the gaby boom. I'm 30 years old, so this was before very many gay or lesbians were having babies. And my mom was very radical, far-left, separatist lesbian, and she's not anymore, you know. She's integrated into the rest of culture. But I was brought up with some pretty extreme values. And my gender, no one would think that I was brought up by these separatist lesbians the way I look, or my gender, the way it's expressed to the outside world. No one would know that. But it did, she did raise me with an open mind. And I would say I definitely took on all those things about gender that I could identify with, that I saw in my outside world, not from my mother.
Yeah, so
my
that's...
mother's been married for 14 years. She's married in Canada. She's married in California to the same woman. They're not your traditional family in that one is a bit younger than the other. But other than that, it's very traditional. So, they're a pillar in their community. My mom is the matriarch of our family.
So, Magdalena, do you find yourself, I'm not clear from your story, in a traditional kind of gender role, traditional kind of marriage and family of your own?
I've been in a committed relationship for 7 years and married for 2 years. We had a beautiful, beautiful wedding ceremony with our whole community there. It was the best day of my life, and my life changed. Getting married, the very act of getting married was very important. I'm married to a transsexual man who was a woman when I started dating him. And a couple years into our relationship, it became clear to him that he needed to transition. And getting married is the best thing I've ever done. I loved it. And we had people from all walks of life at our wedding. And I just think it is an incredible rite of passage. And no one should be told that they can't experience that.
Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot for your story, Magdalena. Michael, you got any comment or reaction?
Well, it rings a bell for me in that some of the same-sex couples that I've interviewed who have never thought they would have the opportunity to get married, and then the window opened and they were able to marry, for instance, in California when it was legal, they were surprised at how big a difference it meant to them. That is, they had already discounted it. And mm-hmm. there's certainly plenty of gay rights activists who don't think the marriage issue should be the central issue and so on. But there's, I think, couples themselves long ago decided, you know, we don't need this. It's not for us. And yet, there's so much cultural freight, so much historical baggage, and so much importance to that marriage document that actually when people go through it, they find that it does make a difference.
Right. I mean, I think, again, I don't want to harp on Hegel, who's not one of my favorite philosophers.
Is he here?
But no, he's not one of my favorite philosophers. But I think he has a profound thought about marriage. When we get married, we will something different. And it's not just a matter of inclination and feeling. He calls it willing the union, but it's I think of it as commitment, which is mm-hmm. different from desire, you know. So I think there's something important here. And we've got more callers in the line. Ashi in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ashi.
Thank you. Thank you for the show. And I hope you're going to be able to answer my questions because I'm struggling with them. I believe, ethically, profoundly, that two committed adults should, whatever their gender, should have the same rights. Now, I have two questions, which are, first, all the societies, tribes, even the animal kingdom, traditionally have grown because they've been able to reproduce and protect their little ones. So my first question is, does it make no difference in terms of, civil marriage that we decide that whether you can reproduce together or not, it's just the same thing? And my second question is there any study of the impact, the psychological impact, on kids who have little or no idea who their biological parents are, or in some cases they might have know who one of their parents are? I know adoption exists, but that's the exception, not the rule, and in some cases they can actually find out who their biological parents are. So is it just, doesn't it matter at all that these kids will never know who their biological parents are?
Ashi, thanks for the call. But I should say something about adoption these days. I mean, I have an adopted son, and most adoption these days are open adoption. So the idea that adopted children don't know who their biological parents are is becoming rapidly a thing of the past. But Michael, you got anything there?
Well, a few things. One is most children raised by same-sex couples know their parents one of the partners in the same-sex union had a previous hetero partner. So it's sort of like step families in heterosexual families. So that's the first thing. The second thing is you have to remember that same-sex couples are only 1 or 2% of all the couples. So if we're worried about fertility of the society as a whole, it's true same-sex couples have fewer children, but on the other hand, you know, society-wide fertility is not governed by them. It's the heterosexual families and their fertility choices.
I take your point, but again, I'm not a conservative, but I'm going to speak for the conservative. It's what you present as an ideal, as a norm, as the point. If one of the points of family is to continue collective life and to be the center of the continuation of collective life, is there anything wrong with privileging heterosexual marriage because it's the primary engine? You could make it not the primary engine of the reproduction and continuing narration of the life of the species and the community. You can make it not that. But is there anything deeply wrong with making the heterosexual family the primary engine, of trying to make the heterosexual family the primary engine of that stuff?
It always will be, because they'll always be the dominant group in terms of numbers. So, it's certainly not the case that the legality of same-sex marriage will mean that gay couples will be all the couples in the world. That's not true. They'll always be a pretty small minority. The question is, do we want that small minority to have rights?
Just interject that the world's big problem isn't having too few people. Right. I mean, there are maybe Italy and a couple of places are having declining birth rates, or maybe they're demographic bulges here and there. But basically, it's fewer heterosexual couples and the more couples that are raising children that they didn't create is fine with me, but maybe that's a minority view.
Yeah, well, I'm not. The fact of heterosexuality and the predominance of heterosexuality means it's going to be a fact that heterosexuals predominate, but still normatively predominate. That's a different question, right? And whether the society should normatively privilege these things is a different question. I don't know what your answer is to whether society should normatively privilege those things.
I think people find their own way through the sexual identity question, and they don't really need, I don't think heterosexuals need the normative privilege to find it. It's there and it's available.
Yeah. We've got time for one last caller. Alan in Burlingame's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alan.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I really appreciate your program. And I know that you're talking about gender and those kind of things in the postmodern family, but what I see is the proliferation or the ignorance of the parental engagement with children and so on because of technical devices such as texting and cell phones and so on, such to the point where parents are walking their children or pushing the baby carriage along, but they're talking to their friends and perhaps not engaging their children, kind of doing the one-on-one and exposing them to nature, or parents at restaurants staring into their BlackBerry or what have you, looking for a text message. And I wonder what that is going to, how those children are going to develop. It's like the technical device is more important than I am. So how are those children, what is the connectivity going to be as those children get older?
So thanks for the call, Alan. Briefly, this will be your last comment.
It's exceptionally hard to be a parent in this postmodern world because we don't know what the future holds. And it is true that the technology is invasive into the home and takes away time that parents would be spending with children. And the truth is, what children need most is attention from their parents, and nothing can substitute for that.
Yeah. On that note, Michael, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a very nice conversation.
It's been my pleasure.
Our guest has been Michael Rosenfeld, professor of sociology at Stanford University, author of The Age of Independence, Interracial Unions, Same-Sex Unions, and the Changing American Family. This conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. It's already been started, in fact.